thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing news source.
Well, Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market, it's a pleasure to welcome him back today. Founder of ArmstrongEconomics.com, plus the must-see movie, The Forecaster. Welcome back, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you back. Hope it's warmer in Florida today.
It's a little cool for us down here. I mean, this is the... Unfortunately, we're going into this global cooling with solar minimums still going down.
You know, you've been spot on U.S. equities, one of only two or three of our guests to remain bullish on equities. You've cited global money flows in the past pouring into the U.S., keeping our domestic equities strong. Tell us what you see, and will these happy days continue?
Yeah, I think that the biggest problem in analysis is that the vast majority of what people tend to hear is really just domestic. They focus on, oh, what's the interest rates, what's the Fed going to do, as if nothing else in the world matters. Effectively, we have a real serious political meltdown going on in Europe. That's what's really behind the repo crisis. And they won't even discuss that in any kind of a remotely truthful fashion, because they're really... Honestly, they're scared to death of what's on the horizon. I mean, I've written many times about, you know, the sovereign debt crisis, etc., but people have to realize that the structural design of Europe is really an abomination. It's, you know, everything that they told people to sell the euro was just flatly a lie. I mean, they came to me when they were starting this, and I told them you have to consolidate the debts, otherwise the euro is never going to be able to compete with the dollar. And at the time, the head of Germany, Kohl, I mean, he said, no, he can't do that, and no consolidation of the debts, and they couldn't pull this off without him. Most people don't realize that what he did, he admitted that he acted like a dictator. He wouldn't even allow a referendum to be voted on by the German people because he knew he would lose. So he took what he thought would be the major issue that they would object to, and no consolidation of the debts. Now, the problem with that is that this is what's behind the bail-ins of banks, because, okay, fine, if the Italian bank is in trouble, well, we can't bail that out with money coming from Germany. So they basically failed to, you know, say, okay, fine, they've adopted a bail-in situation. Now you take this repo crisis. What's really going on is, why have banks pulled back and unwilling to lend? And, I mean, the latest BIS report is really just BS. Because if Deutsche Bank goes down and Europe says, okay, fine, we're only doing bail-ins, and they have positions with Deutsche Bank from the United States, so now we're looking at just an absolute default. Nobody's going to do a bailout. The Fed can't come rushing in and bail out Deutsche Bank. It's in Germany. So it's everybody's basically pulled back, and nobody wants to deal with anybody at this stage, because it is a great unknown as to who has what exposure to any European bank. So, yes, it's true. I mean, we wrote about it. You know, J.P. Morgan, you know, backed out. But it's also part of the, you know, the Basel III Accord regulations, which was put in place by the BIS. And everybody has constantly said this is ridiculous, but they're just bureaucrats. They have never been in the real world. They don't trade markets, and these people just put up stuff that causes huge problems. And I mean, MiFID II. I mean, they were like, oh well, okay, fine, we're going to have to delay it because the bankers admit that this is going to really blow them up. I mean, kids out of university, and they're writing these laws of things that they have no clue about.
And, you know, Jim Cramer of Mad Money fame, a lot of investors are still, they're gun-shy, you know, after the 2000 bubble peak, the dot-com bust, and then again in 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. It made a lot of investors nervous. The flash crashes along the way. You've remained bullish. Do you still expect $50,000 Dow? Does that still look like a reality to you? And, of course, 10,000 NASDAQ?
It looks actually more like around 65,000 on the Dow, but you're talking about going out to around 2032. I mean, there will have to be a correction first and then a slingshot back out. Major crisis in government bonds. The negative yielding bonds that they have issued, it's like a bunch of people trading gold contracts. They're not actually taking physical delivery. Everyone's just buying, you know, the futures back and forth. This is the same thing in these negative bonds. Nobody's holding them. Okay, it's just a bunch of punters going back, oh, okay, fine, they might lower interest rates so I can make a little bit on this, and they buy it and they sell it. The problem is going to be is that what the repo crisis is all about that is not being discussed. The Federal Reserve, with the whole quantitative easing, etc., they were buying in 30-year bonds, etc., because the Fed has no control over long-term interest rates. So it was trying to buy in the long-term bonds to create a shortage to, in hopes that the interest rate would decline and they would lend money more into the mortgages. Now we're dealing with a short-term. The Fed has always been in charge of the short-term. They can raise rates, lower rates, etc. They were trying to lower rates when the repo crisis hit. So those of us in, you know, that have real international experience, what that means is that the Fed has lost control of also the short-term rates. So that the rates popped to 10%, the Fed, this is not quantitative easing. They're trying to keep the interest rates down. And so the free market is showing that there's a lack of confidence. Nobody knows what's going on. They don't trust the banks in Europe. And the capital has been pouring more into the equity markets than because you can't trust the bonds. Now, the amount of money invested in bonds versus equities is about 10 to 1. And that's what's been going on. Europe is an absolute basket case. I mean, I just wrote a piece. I mean, there's rising, you know, even Macron admitted that in France, that if the people were given an opportunity to vote, they would vote also to leave. This is just getting to be a very, very serious situation that Europe never correctly designed anything. And the euro, it's not really reserve currency. The central banks that I talk to outside of Europe, who wants to hold euro as a reserve currency when it's paying a negative interest rate? The central banks don't want to hold it.
Negative interest rates where I'm going to pay you to hold my money. It's clearly distress all throughout, systemically throughout the system. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. What they want to know is, what is it going to lead to, Martin Armstrong?
Basically, it's what I've been writing about with like what I call Big Bang. Is effectively, everybody knows, I mean, I probably meet with more central banks and governments than I think anybody, but and even that is weird in many ways. I mean, our CEO in Europe is British. I go to meet in Brussels. I can't even bring him. I'm okay because I have no skin in the game. I'm an American. I said, can I bring Ashley? Oh, no, he's British, you see. I mean, because then they assume whatever he says is going to be in favor of Britain. It's the weirdest position I think I've ever been in. The same thing, I mean, in Canada, I said, you know, how come you can talk to me but not the finance minister in Nova Scotia? And I go, well, you're not Canadian. Okay? It's just very, very strange. But this is off the charts. I mean, I meet with so many of them, and I ask them, I said, why do we continue to borrow year after year when there's absolutely no intention of ever paying anything back? And they just look at you with a dumb look, and they go, well, that's the way it works. I said, really? I've had some said, yeah, but look, we're paying back with cheaper, you know, cheaper currency in the future. Nobody would design a world monetary system. I've just finished a book because I've been under so much pressure. People have said, would you put something out on this? It's on Amazon. We have shipped it to them. It's called Manipulating the World Economy. It's about 400 and some odd pages. I've gone through absolutely everything, all the central banks and everything. I've put this out largely because of this. I've been requested to put something out that at least goes into this new monetary theory, et cetera. And I mean, it's just check on Amazon. They will be available. I know they just got them from the printers. They already have a review up, but they're just saying unavailable just yet. So I don't know when they're going to start selling them. But that's probably the most extensive book that you'll ever find on the world monetary system. And it goes into this thing from an international perspective. We've never gotten to this point, I think, in history ever. Interest rates being negative, this is a 5,000-year low. The way they do economics is that they're like a medieval doctor. Oh, you have an earache? Well, let's cut it off and see if that helps. All of this is just experiment. I will say, you have to sometimes read between the lines. When Trump was coming out and say, oh, the Fed should go to, negative interest rates, Diamond of, J.P. Morgan, he actually came out and said, negative interest rates, it's an experiment and we don't know exactly how that's going to work out. What he's saying is this is crazy. He can't come out as forcefully as I am saying, look, this is going to crash. The problem then becomes, in Europe particularly, because they're much more socialistic than America, a lot of the pension funds are under obligation to have only government bonds. Some of them are 80% must be in government bonds. And these are private funds. I mean, in our case, Social Security is 100% in government bonds. Here you have negative interest rates, and honestly, the bonds are just going to crash. As I said, the repo crisis is interest rates are showing there is a risk. And an interest rate is the price of future expectations of inflation and risk. And there's no way they're at negative. Absolutely no way. I mean, the ECB has bought about 40% of the national debts of Europe. It's kept them on life support. They've completely destroyed their bond market, and so has Japan. And, I mean, Japan even bragged, oh, we bought 97% of the auction. This is a good thing? You've wiped out the free market. So, in other words, if you suddenly actually do have to borrow money instead of printing it for yourself, there's no buyers. What are you going to do? People don't realize that the people that we have in these positions have no experience whatsoever. Look at Christine Lagarde. She was a lawyer in Chicago who was a friend with Obama, and he stuck her in for the IMF. Everybody goes, oh, gee, would you go to, take a taxi driver and say, gee, I have a headache. Would you mind doing a brain surgery for me? I mean, there's no qualifications for any position. Most of them are just lawyers, honestly. And, nobody has a degree to run a country or to be the head of a central bank. They don't do this. There's no degrees to go get hedge fund management, whatever. I mean, I was in Europe and three of the top 10 universities asked me if I would teach there. And I looked at them and I said, why? Why are you asking me? And they actually said to me that they knew what they taught doesn't work.
If we could switch over to the precious metals, we've had a good year so far on gold and silver. Well, look at palladium. It's more than doubled in the past 12 months or so. I mean, could we see a moment like that with silver or gold on a forward basis?
Eventually, yes. What it's going to take is, and I'm not talking about your readers, but the average person on the street to understand some of the things I'm talking about. That's what going into 1980 was all about. The average person suddenly didn't trust government. It didn't, you know, you have to get the average person to the point where they say, I better spend these dollars today because they're going to be worth less tomorrow. When we reach that point, that's when your precious metals, et cetera, will take off. It's not, you know, these people, oh, it's quantitative easing, they're going to increase. The average person has no clue about that. They're just sales jobs that they've been pitching for decades. All right. But it's all about confidence. And this is what, like, the repo crisis, they're lacking the confidence in banks. So banks are no longer trusting banks. That's what you're actually seeing. The Feds had to step in because the banks don't want to take the paper or lend to another bank because they don't know what their exposure will be. It could be another Lehman moment and nobody trusts it. So the same thing in the precious metals. When we get to that degree where people suddenly realize that the central banks have lost control, they can't control short-term interest rates anymore. And then you'll start seeing interest rates going up, and actually gold will rise with interest rates. Because that will be the point where what you're seeing is a lack of confidence in the system. And people will see that as a risk. As the risk increases, the interest rate will go up. Okay? I was an active trader back going into 1980, and you can see interest rates were going up all the time. Gold finally peaked in 1980. Interest rates went up further into 1981. But what you're looking at that point, they got so high, you had to look at it and say, okay, fine, I can get a CD that's paying 20% guaranteed for 10 years. Should I do that or should I hold the gold? They looked at the 20% and they took it. So it's a bell curve. I mean, it's not linear. It's not that you raise interest rates perpetually and gold goes to zero. At some point, it's a bell curve and they split. So gold will rise with interest rates, all right, and that's what you're going to be looking at, and because it will reflect the decline in confidence in government. Short term, you still have the risk of it going back to retest support next year, and then you're probably going to start seeing this thing move up from most likely from around 2021 on forward. We're also looking at this nonsense, for example, of the global warming and all of that. It's crazy. I mean, Canada, they put a tax on every house for global warming. It's not the money's going someplace to actually do something. It's like, well, we'll just punish them and we'll get rich in the process and call it global warming. And that's what's going on. It's led to the yellow vest movements over there in France when they put on, Macron tried to put on this global warming tax on gasoline. We have to really look at, gold is going to close at least this year above basically 1433. If it can do that, it's showing it's starting to hold up on a longer term basis. Otherwise, it closed below that. We can still see a sharp decline, then a slingshot back out. But our models are showing, for example, we're looking going into the next business cycle peak, which will be probably 2024. And when we're looking at that, this next cycle should be a commodity cycle. So the global cooling that we're seeing, has really impacted agricultural, quite a bit. And so we see the ags rising. So you're going to see more or less a cost push type of inflation, which will eventually at the end turn into a demand inflation. But at first it's going to be, cost push and taxes are rising. Raw commodities will be rising. So that then ends up pushing the cost of things up. And the governments are in serious, serious trouble. And, I mean, you have Macron is trying to federalize Europe because France is not going to be able to handle all its social, you know, benefits. And it has much more social benefits than anybody else in Europe. So his idea is that, gee, if we federalize, then it's not me, it's Brussels that will tell you you can't have this much. And that's what's going on. So a lot of the French are quite up in arms. There's a lot of protests over there from the unions. They don't want to give up their pension benefits, and you're having them, or they're being joined by the LFS. So Macron stood for election right now, he would lose.
Turning back to potential for a global currency crisis, you're not one of those then who sees global hegemony of the U.S. dollar, its reserve currency status, under fire on a forward basis, and the race to the bottom, I think, is the mantra that we hear in the commodities crowd. You think that's on hold for the time being?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, that's very nice scenarios that they always paint. They've been saying it for like 30 years. That's not the way systems collapse. If you look at anything, it's the dollar has to go up. That's what breaks the system. All right, 1934, the dollar had gone up so much, FDR confiscated gold and devalued the dollar. 1985, the dollar went up dramatically. All right, you had, that's when they formed G5. All right, the pound went to par. They stood up and they said, we're going to devalue the dollar by 40%. All right, the U.S. always wants the dollar down. Europe always is the opposite. It stems from World War II to some degree. Europeans, their currencies were starting from zero. So it was like the Deutschmark was up from 25 cents against the dollar to 29. See, vote for me. I've done a really good job. The Deutschmark's up. Whereas an American president can't run and say, well, vote for me because the dollar's up against Canada or Mexico. Everybody would go, yeah, what's that got to do with anything? So the U.S. has always wanted a lower dollar. That's what, you know, Trump keeps talking about, too. And you go to Europe, and it's the opposite. The strong currency shows the politicians are doing a good job. So what's going to break the system is a dollar rally, not a dollar decline. And again, this is domestic versus international analysis. These people only look at the domestic side. And you got Japan in negative interest rates, and it really is a basket case. Europe is an absolute basket case. China is in a recessionary trend. The U.S. dollar is the only thing holding up the world right now. And 70% of the dollars are actually trading outside the United States. Then you add to that, why is the dollar the reserve currency? Because, one, we've never canceled the dollar. The dollar bill from 1861 is still valid. It's worth a lot more to a collector, but it's still $5. On top of that, anybody can issue debt in dollars. So you can't do that in Japan. In Japan, if you want to issue a bond in dollar in yen, you have to have the permission of the government. Their currency controls in these things. So U.S., anybody can issue a bond in dollars. So you have all the emerging markets have issued debt in dollars in order to get American investors to buy it. Story I wrote about this about last month. Italy suddenly looking to issue dollar-denominated debt, not euro. Why? Because they can't sell the euro at these negative rates. No private investor will come in, so they're issuing debt in dollars. So the crisis becomes, as the dollar goes up, all these other countries that have done this end up in default. So as they default, you have the money rushing more to the United States, and it pushes the dollar up. This is exactly what happened also in the Great Depression. In 1931, all these countries defaulted. So as they were defaulting, everybody rushed to the dollar. Then the dollar was the last one standing, and it was so high then that's what Roosevelt came in and said, okay, fine, we're going to have to devalue the dollar. And then that's when it crashed, all right? But it's the same thing. As the dollar goes up, it will undermine Trump and his trade, all right? So everything begins to fall apart. If the dollar goes down, we're going to be selling stuff all over the world. Trump will be happier than anything. Jobs will be created. It's exactly opposite of what these people keep saying.
Okay, so for the most part, though, you're ignoring the trade tariff mess. I mean, you know, we heard recently that we might be looking at South American aluminum and steel tariffs increasing. That was the latest to be thrown on there. But then on the other hand, they're talking about holding off on the Beijing big bump up there and with our largest trading partner, those tariffs until after the election, November of next year. Then that might encourage investors, maybe, don't you think, to come back to the table for U.S. equity?
If you look at it, the only ones that went away from the table were Americans, because they're reading all the local press. Someone overseas in Europe, they're looking at their situation first. And if they see political chaos, disruptions in capital flows, what's going to happen with Brexit, they move out. They just diversify. Give me some U.S. Equity. And that's what they've been doing. We had an inverted yield curve before the repo crisis. I wrote about that. I said, I'm sorry, it has nothing to do with going into the recession. This is a tremendous amount of capital coming in from overseas because of the euro. And they were basically buying everything they could. And yet all the newspapers are going, oh, Trump's going to lose. We're into a recession. This is inverted yield curve means that we're going down the tubes. Nothing happened. They don't understand international analysis. They really don't.
So if you were going to construct a winning portfolio for the next 12 to 24 months, where would you start?
Well, really have to wait till we get through January. If there's going to be a correction in the stock market, it's going to be from January. The maximum time I think that you could see a correction would be probably into early 2021 before we then turn up. And as far as a correction would be concerned, you're not really looking at major, but it could be something like in the 20% range. And then you're going to have all these people coming back. See, I told you I was right. You know, I've been wrong for 19 years, but hey, you know, I'm right now, and we're going to go back, and they're going to be talking about the Dow going down to, you know, 10,000 or whatever. You know, just look at it from logical perspective. If governments are in trouble, do you really want to buy their debt, particularly at these low levels? You know, you can. It's just a preposterous theory that they always keep putting out, and it's all done by domestic stuff, and all they ever look at is, oh, what's the Fed want to do to us next? And that's really it. We have to look at this thing from an international perspective. I mean, that's what an international hedge fund manager, you got to watch what's happening in every country around the world, and you move accordingly, and that's what's going on. So, I mean, capital is just not going to sit there and look at, you know, just what the Fed is doing. That's domestic analysis. If you just plot the Dow and Euro, you'll see it's up about 15 to 20% more than it would be in dollars.
But what do you see the risk of policies coming into play, hampering our business strength that we've enjoyed over the last few years and turning interest more to monetary stimulus to line the pockets of their cronies and programs burning the U.S. dollar?
That's eventually. That's like probably after 2022. This is a major political confrontation between the left and the right. And as we go between here in 2032, this is an absolute war. All right. And government, as we have known it up to this point in time, was at least they could function and be bipartisan on certain issues. The Democrats, it's just, you know, so vindictive. I mean, like what they did with Kavanaugh, et cetera. This has a major impact. You know, regardless of what you think what Kavanaugh did or did not do, this was talking going back to high school, I mean, back to college. And no reports were filed, et cetera. I mean, I knew Steve Moore. who Trump was going to put in, you know, for Fed chairman. Within a week, he's attacked, his wife's attacked. He says, look, take my name out of the bucket. That's it. I'm not interested. Nobody is interested that I know of that would be a good qualified person after Kavanaugh who wants to step into this stuff. It doesn't even require something that you actually did. Oh, well, this girl says you did something and that was 30 years ago. How do you prove this kind of stuff? So the problem is that by doing that, you've now changed the game. And even if the Democrats were to get back to the House, now the Republicans will do it to them. This is what I mean, that functioning government has come to an end. You see this stuff, oh, Trump is not my president. Where is this coming from? I mean, there were people that voted against Obama. Okay, fine, he won, and they just moved on. People don't move on anymore. It's like, no, I'm going to protest. I'm going to do it. It's the idea of actual civilization has come to an end. It's supposed to be equal protection of the law. Okay, that's what it's supposed to be. We all get along. Okay, fine. I may disagree with your political views or whatever, but we get along. Okay, that's what civilization is about, because it's more beneficial for us to all work together than to be separate. And when you start separating like this, then we're back to tribal warfare practically. And that's the declining cycle of civilization. So that's how Rome broke up. As soon as you start putting one group against another, then it doesn't work anymore.
Your thoughts on cryptos? You know, Bitcoin and Ethereum had a spectacular rally, you might say, or at least let's call it a rebound, a bounce. Do you have any good news at all for crypto investors?
Not really. I mean, you just have to look at it from a realistic perspective. What government is going to allow you to have a currency that is going to displace the Rome? Look, they got the guns, they've got the tanks, all right? You have Christine Lagarde, who at the IMF was advocating everybody should create their own cryptocurrency. That's so they can keep control. In Germany, they just said, okay, fine, the banks can be the custodian for the various different cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin. Okay, it's just a fraction of a second it's going to take. Oh, okay, fine. Your Bitcoin is now going to be converted to the government cryptocurrency. You have to realize government can do anything it wants and it never follows the rule of law. Italy, when they couldn't pay the debt the last time, you had 90-day paper. What did they do? Instead of saying, oh, gee, we can't pay, we're going to have to default. No, they converted it and they said, okay, fine, your 90-day paper is now 10-year. Thank you very much. And that was it. you can't, you know, what are you going to do? I believe that from discussions I've had over the years with them, is that they allow Bitcoin to go. This is the experiment, okay? If they did it, it would be hostile. governments, what are they doing? Let Bitcoin go. Let all the infrastructure, everybody get used to it. Oh, cryptocurrency, yes, okay. And then the government can just turn the switch anytime it wants. That's what I think they'll do, because I do not see government ever allowing anything be in competition with them.
Judging by what I've heard from the SEC and a few of their folks and whatnot, it seems to me that they view it as a kind of silly magic internet digital money. It's more of a software. Even at the top of the pyramid have quite grasped that eventually, I mean, this will be probably de facto money. If you spend any time in the crypto world, you realize they can't stop a transaction. It can't be reversed. It's frictionless. It's efficient. The transparency and the efficiency of it is kind of compelling.
What you have to look at against that is that, one, why are they saying that the negative interest rates failed? If you look at that in Europe, and Christine Lagarde's been a big proponent of this, saying that, okay, and even, Larry Summers to some degree, said that the reason negative interest rates didn't work is because people could hoard their cash. They just took it out of the banks and didn't pay the negative interest rate. So the proposals have been running around is to get rid of cash. That's been, I would say, where you're going to see it probably the most is going to be definitely with Europe. I mean, Sweden, there's a lot of places no longer accept cash. I mean, even in the United States, you go into like parking lots for, you know, they don't accept cash. It's all, you know, card. That's definitely where we're going. All right. But if they move to the point of eliminating cash, and this is what their theory is, why I've done this book on this manipulating the world economy, is then you're dealing with something where what they would do is also go after the crypto world. And just look at what Lagarde has been saying. And she says each country should have its own cryptocurrency. Their benefit would be is you pay 100% taxes. All right? They can just take whatever they want out of your account whenever they want. So I do think that, you know, there'll be a black market. There always is, no matter what you do. Will they ever really be able to completely eliminate any sort of cash? I mean, just, you know, look at prisons. What did they use? They used fish and cigarettes and whatever for money. We will probably end up doing the same thing. But all I'm saying is that, yes, the cryptocurrencies are a trading vehicle at this stage in life. All right. What you have to be concerned about is when the debt really starts to crash, what will government do at that stage? And they will get desperate. At that stage in the game, I think all bets are off because they will do whatever they have to do to basically survive.
You know, you start to talk about a cashless society. I can't think of a better way, though, to kind of crystallize and secure your family's wealth than to put it in something outside the system, you know, like real estate or gold, silver, numismatics, bullion, jewelry, things of that nature before that happened.
Yeah, keep in mind that real estate is really leveraged. All right, so the value of a house is predicated upon somebody getting a 30-year mortgage. If there are no mortgages available because the banks don't want to lend, what's the value of your house? They drop dramatically because it's whoever can pay cash. So I would be careful about that. But as far as equities, things of this nature, look, I think the equities are probably far safer because the government's not going to nationalize General Motors and all the rest of them and just take everything. I mean, at that point, we're going to have civil war in the streets and people are going to be shooting back. Plus, the politicians, you know, that's where they have a lot of their money. So they're not going to necessarily do something like that. The real estate's at risk mainly because of the banking system, but not necessarily any particular rule of law or something along those lines. For the average individual, yeah, the precious metals, what, you know, you won't be able to hop on a plane with a suitcase full of gold and go to St. Kitts or something, but, I mean, they'll confiscate it from you. But, you know, there are definitely different ways of doing things. There was a guy in Italy who had a suitcase full of about $100 million worth of bonds and hopped on a train from Italy going to Switzerland. They basically took it. They stopped the trains. They're searching everything they possibly can.
I saw that article, and you know the interesting thing about that, if he just memorized an 8 or a 12 code crypto key, you know, he could have done the same thing with a small transaction fee or simply stored in an email online. So, I mean, that could have gone a lot better without using bonds.
That's how the Chinese were getting, they were using Bitcoin to get a lot of the money out of the country. They were doing that. I mean, I just posted actually on our site a First Circuit decision that it was illegal that TSA people were just taking your phones and confiscating them and looking, and your laptops, and looking to see if you had any money hidden, any accounts or something like that. They just ruled on that and said, no, it's illegal for them. It violates the Fourth Amendment, and they have to have probable cause. So they go, well, I think, you know. I mean, it's when I come back, they're no longer interested in, did you buy any T-shirts that we can get some taxes on? The number one question I get, how much money you got on you? I mean, I was in Brussels meeting over there in Parliament, and I just hopped on the train through the tunnel to London. So I still had a suit and tie on. Everybody else has got jeans and sneaks. I'm walking through. I'm the one pulled over. And I said, I am American. I don't live. It doesn't matter. I might be an expat living in London. They wanted to see the ticket. Where did I buy the ticket? I said, I bought the ticket in Brussels. I'm flying back to the States from Frankfurt. I don't live here. Then they let me go.
It's a dystopian future you're sort of outlining for us today. And, I mean, it sounds to me like if conditions started to deteriorate like we saw in 1939 Europe, I mean, the only way out would be liquefy all assets into cryptos, cross the border, use your cryptos to buy precious metals in a safe country, if there is a safe jurisdiction.
That's another problem. It's like what I have said to people. Look, I've been in this game for more than 40 years, and we would have a crisis in one country versus another. This is a crisis absolutely everywhere. I mean, I was in Asia, and I was there for like 3 months. I mean, with the Hong Kong riots and stuff like that, we had clients on absolutely both sides, plus in the middle. What do we do? What do we do? I mean, because they're looking at the capital markets moving from Hong Kong to Singapore. I mean, it is everywhere you go.
Do you see something like that spreading to the West?
Oh, yes. It's coming here. There's no question about it. We're okay right now. It's very divisive to the whole country. And you end up with, it's chaos. It's political chaos. And a lot of these people are just, look at the number of shootings that we're starting to get. I mean, you have one down here in Florida, then 2 days later up in Jersey City. I mean, this is, it's rising. The level of frustration is rising dramatically in this country, and it's going to pop. I think the 2020 election is going to really be back to the 60s as far as on a scale of violence, except race. It's not going to be race. It's going to be, you know, left versus right. I mean, there are signs that people aren't going to accept the election. Doesn't matter who. Republicans won't, and the Democrats won't. So what does that mean? Like I said, it's no longer, okay, we lost, let's move on. It's not like that anymore.
But don't you think, though, the U.S. equities markets, you know, money flows that you see just traditionally are such a good predictor of chaos. Have you ever seen, like, a global conflict that wasn't predicted by either the London Stock Exchange, European or U.S.? Early 1990s conflicts in the Middle East, I mean, we saw months in advance a pullback, the money gets scared. Is it really that dismal of a future if equities continue to make new highs?
Yes, because this is being made from international capital, all right, not domestic. And you have to understand, the United States in 1896, that's when J.P. Morgan had to arrange a $100 million loan in gold because the U.S. was basically bankrupt. You had William Jennings Bryan running for president, you know, thou shalt not crucify mankind on the cross of gold and all that stuff. They were against the gold standard. They wanted just overvaluing silver. It was basically quantitative easing just with the precious metals. So between that period where we're absolutely near bankruptcy as a country, then by World War I, we emerged as the strongest economy in the world. Because the U.S. didn't have the tanks going down our streets. We made all the food and everything else. And most likely the richest man ever in history other than Roman Emperor Augustus basically lost virtually everything he had. It was Ogden Armour. He was supplying all the food and like Armour hot dogs for the Allies. And when the commodity markets crashed from 1919 into 1921, he died penniless. He lost absolutely everything he had. You know, I had read the one of his comments before he died. They said, you know, how you, you know, what do you think your legacy is? He said, I'll always be remembered for losing more money than anybody. And that was it. But the U.S. became the world's largest economy because of World War I and then World War II. At the end of World War II, we ended up with 76% of the world gold reserves. Everybody moved money here, plus everything that was being bought from, you know, from arms and food, etc. That's how the U.S. became the strongest economy in the world.
Well, Martin Armstrong, why don't you tell us what's going on at Armstrong Economics, your latest resources, and whether or not you're working on a new video or movie, anything interesting there?
Yes, actually, I just did spend 2 days on shooting for a sequel that they want to put out. But we're just getting inundated from all over the place. I mean, we've got like 3 offices in Asia and all up and down in Europe. And it's because the whole world is just going crazy everywhere. I just put out this new book. It is on Amazon, Manipulating the World Economy. I'm not sure when they're going to start selling it, but the page is up, and I see they already have reviews on it. We did hand it out at the World Economic Conference. We had it in Orlando. This year, we're probably going to have 3 conferences because we're just getting, you know, so many requests around the world. So, and this particular session was a little bit more difficult because our clients from China couldn't come in because of the trade problems and nobody went to get visas, etc. So in May, we're holding a conference in China, actually in Shanghai. Then we'll probably be doing one in Frankfurt, most likely, I think, in June, and then back to the United States in November. So we're just really at this stage in the game, we're all over the place because of international. We have probably more clients outside the country than anybody else combined, I would say. That's just always been the way it has been. So I'm trying to get a couple other books out as quickly as possible. I'm redoing The Greatest Bull Market. I'm trying to get as much out as I possibly can before we really get into this major crisis between 21 and 22.
Interesting. Okay, 2021, 2022 looks like a very volatile time, according to Martin Armstrong. Really excited to hear about this new follow-up to The Forecaster. Of course, that was the must-see video outlining your career, you know, the challenges that you overcame, tumultuous investing career. Folks who want to get in touch with them, of course, armstrongeconomics.com. Thank you, Martin Armstrong.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
The blockchain revolution is transforming the global arena, disrupting every industry in its path. GoldSeek.com is excited to introduce an off-the-chain opportunity in digital gold and silver from our friends at Atmex and Sprott.com. One Gold holds physical gold and silver metals at the Royal Canadian Mint, the first online marketplace to offer secure and convenient buying, selling, and redemption of digital precious metals. One Gold uses Vault Chain, a secure, immutable blockchain ledger developed by Tradewind Markets, the leading innovator in digital precious metals, distributed ledger, and blockchain technology. Vault Chain. Gold and silver are 100% redeemable through One Gold for physical precious metals delivered to customers' doors in any size at competitive prices and low transaction storage costs. As a special offer and for a limited time only, One Gold is offering gold and silver at spot price with no additional premiums. OneGold.com is secure and accessible 24/7 on any device, offering convenient purchases and sales of precious metals. Easy recurring transactions make passive saving and gold dollar cost averaging as easy as a single mouse click. Vault Chain offers the best tier pricing on AppMex products, setting the industry standard as a fully backed physical asset with easy redemption in coins, rounds, or bars, offering clients peace of mind and full transparency. Don't get left behind. Remember to bookmark OneGold.com for the safest and most convenient digital precious metals today. Remember, OneGold. GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice. Shopping for fine jewelry just got easier. GoldSeek.com has identified the most successful jewelry brand to launch in recent times. Many Jewelry is rewriting the way consumers buy fine jewelry. Integrity Craftsmanship, the only company to sell 24-karat gold and platinum jewelry, avoiding confusing alloys and gems, a true precious metals investment. Many Jewelry's disruptive business model embraces Franco-American craftsmanship and direct-to-consumer economics, rapidly disrupting the $20 billion monopoly, just like Amazon and Uber. The sky is the limit
with $1 billion of jewelry purchases daily for loved ones and those special occasions. Mani Jewelry is an innovator positioned to capture market share with annual sales growth in the industry topping $30 billion by 2021. Mani Jewelry coined the term investment jewelry, pricing by the gram, transparently disclosing its profit margins, a truer investment in pure gold or platinum. Similar to real estate, even artwork, Mani Jewelry has a weighted value easily calculated, ensuring value wealth as a long-term investment. With sales in 60 countries around the globe, 20,000 orders already, don't miss out on the explosive growth potential. Mani Jewelry trades under the symbols MENE on the Toronto Exchange and in the US, MENEF. Remember to sign up to Mani's Shareholder Club to receive shareholder news, updates, and special discount codes for jewelry purchases. Remember, Mani Jewelry.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.